Ay. Where's John? Why do we not have John?
I'm working on it. I can't get him to connect yet.
It might be just you and me, my friend. Oh, God. Can you imagine the internet revolt that would happen?
What do you think they would hate more? 2 hours of fish or the show without John?
Probably the show without John. I think they would prefer the 2 hours of fish.
I think you're right. Oh, hey, John's here.
Oh, hi, John. What would you think people would dislike more? Would people dislike hearing fish for 2 hours more than hearing the show without you? Or would people dislike hearing the show without you and prefer to hear fish for 2 hours?
Oh, I think they would prefer to hear the fish.
That's exactly what we concluded, that the internet would find and smote Marco and I if you were not here.
I don't really hear any fish because, again, I never listened to the live stream, but the few moments I remember hearing, it's like, it's not terrible, right? It's like they play guitars and bass and drums and, you know, and then someone says something for like two seconds in the middle. And then, you know, even if you don't like it, it's not like you're making people listen to, you know, scream music or something. Yeah, I don't know. I think it would be fine.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I think more people like fish than like us. It might not be these people, but in total.
Fair enough. It is currently the 13th of April. It is a Wednesday night. We just released this week's episode, or Marco did, a few hours ago. But because John is disappearing for a little bit, we are going to be where we are obviously recording right now. So we expect that Apple will buy Nintendo on the 14th of April, and we won't get a chance to talk about it until, I think, the 22nd, which is the next time we'll be recording. So expect all the juicy and interesting things to happen over the next week. You're welcome.
I mean, at least my car was made obsolete yesterday.
That's true. Actually, I completely forgot about that. Yeah, they hit the Tesla with the ugly stick. Come at me, haters.
Yeah, I don't really regret not getting the new one, you know, because like they literally just did a facelift like yesterday, and my car is something like 2.5 weeks old. But the new one, I think overall is probably better. You know, it has better headlights. It has a center console, which I had to like buy a separate third party center console to shove in there. It comes with one.
Oh, I didn't realize it was third party. That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, they had a first party one, but the reviews were terrible. So then they stopped selling it. So, you know, there's a couple of minor improvements, but nothing that really makes me unhappy that I bought, you know, 2.5 weeks ago rather than today.
Yeah. The front, kind of grill fascia area, just, I don't dig it. And a lot of people were coming after me and, you know, kind of rightfully so, and saying, oh, well, you're just judging it because it doesn't look like an old car. It doesn't look like something that blows up old plants and dinosaurs, and you're just being a stupid old man. And yeah, you know, that I might be guilty as charged, and maybe in a few years I won't need to see a grill up front. But sitting here today, I just don't think it's pretty. And somebody had tweeted, I can't recall who it was, but somebody had tweeted, and it's been making the rounds endlessly, the picture of Keanu Reeves as Mr. Anderson. And when in the first movie, his lips disappear, and his face just is, it, you know, it's all kind of one big flat area. And it is a very, very similar likeness to the updated Tesla Model S and the Model 3 as well.
And the X. Because like the Model S. It basically, this all started with the X.
That's true. I'd forgotten about that.
I mean, ultimately, like, I don't think it's really going to be that big of a deal. I think it's more just like, we are not used to seeing cars that are designed this way, and that's why it looks weird, because it's unfamiliar. But
right,
I think
exactly,
within a few months, you know, once you start seeing these on the road and everything, everyone's just going to be like, okay, that's just how cars look sometimes.
No, that's not it. We talked about this last week. I just like forgot everything we talked about. the Model 3 was the one where the Keanu lip sewing shut disappearing matrix thing was going around. Because the Model 3, what we've seen of it anyway, because again, who knows what's final, but what we've seen of the Model 3 is there's nothing there. There's no dividing line, different color patch, different material. It is just one continuous schnoz. And and as we talked about last week, like, it's not so much that we demand to have a grill, right? It's that the car looks like it has a place where a grill should go. Like that they haven't fully embraced the idea that they don't need to pull air into that spot. They have built a car with a spot where a grill would go, but just neglected to put the same reason a face looks weird with a big smooth spot where the mouth should go, because we know that's where the mouth goes. If you want to draw something that doesn't have a mouth, don't draw the place where the mouth goes and then just erase it, right? The X and the new S, they have a grill. They have a little T-shaped thing, which I think is pretty good for Tesla T. You know, every brand has some sort of like signature grill shape that they go with, and they change it over the years, but you know, Audi's got that big sort of big mouth trapezoid thing they go with.
Well, it does look a little bit like a creepy partial mustache, like the skinny stash. Yeah. You know, it looks a little bit like that.
It looks a little bit like Alfa Romeo too. Like it's not like every brand, you know, BMW has the kidneys, so that is a pretty big signature there, but other brands have changed their shape over the years, and sometimes they stick with it for like three or four model generations and they go with a different shape. Anyway, this Tesla thing with the little T, with their actual T logo inside it, that's fine. It's kind of like a grill. I have to see this one in person, because from some angles, the little mustache they have there suffices, as far as I'm concerned, visually, because they put a place for the grill and they put a grill on it. I mean, that basically is a grill. It's not a big grill, but it's a grill. Like, why else have a big like opening in black air? Because other internal combustion engine cars have one. The Model 3 has the same place for that thing to go, but there's nothing there, so it looks weird. And like I said last show, if they want to go with the no grill in the front because they can, fine, go for it, embrace it, make it look like a car that never had a grill, was never intended to have a grill. And they kind of can't do that with the Model S, because they decided with Marco's car to put the big giant ball gag thing there. It looks like a big black grill, but it's just clear plastic, like someone shoved a rubber ball into the mouth of the car and it's like but they made the decision. You can't really reshape the whole car. The other thing that's a factor is pedestrian safety and crash standards probably dictate at the very least the minimum height of the front of the car. So you can't really go whole hog into a styling that totally neglects the grill. So I'm not entirely sure what to do to resolve this, but I know the answer is not what the 3 did, which is make a car with a place for a grill and just fail to put one there.
Yeah, the side view, I'm looking at this post on Jalopnik, which we'll have in the show notes. If you look at it from the side of the car, it actually doesn't look bad at all, but any sort of front angle just looks, it's just this vast emptiness. And it just, I agree with you, John. It looks like a grill belongs there, but isn't there. And I think I prefer this to the Audi I will swallow the world grill that's become so trendy for Audi these days, which is just awful.
Or the new Lexus ones, too, and the new Lexus and Toyota ones.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, the Lexus Lexus has the bow tie shape. Yeah, it's kind of like goes in on the sides.
I forgot about that. That's even worse.
Yeah, and it's like the entire front of the car.
Yeah, it's so bad. Yeah.
That's efficient for cooling if they use all that space. But are you talking about, you're still saying that you don't like the S? Because, Casey, the S has a grill, like the little mustache. It doesn't fill the area. I see there's a big expanse under it that you feel like, right, is a place where more grill,
exactly,
should go, and there isn't,
exactly,
any. And they actually exaggerate it, because if you look, they actually extend down, like the thing that's around the fog lamps, the material goes down even farther, making room, even more room, for the non-existing grill.
Yep, exactly. I just don't care for it.
Anyway, I'm sure it looks fine. And once I see them in person, which, you know, should be any day now, as soon as they start selling them, because they're all over here, I'll have to render judgment of seeing it in person. But I think it looks better than the 3 by far.
Yeah, it does look better than the 3.
I think so, too. And I think of all their, like, including if you look at the X and the S and the 3 together, I think it looks the best out of all three of them, out of the current ones they're producing. Although one concern I have for all three of them is that front area that is body color is just going to get full of bugs and chips.
Ooh, good point.
You know, like, that's always the most damaged area of any car I have, because it's always just covered.
Just put a bra on it.
Oh, oh, God. Are we starting there again?
Yeah, are we going back to this? Oh, God. Anyway, so I agree. I understand that this will probably, at some point, look normal to me. But today, I don't care for it, and I think it looks ugly. All right, so let's not talk about Teslas anymore, and let's start the follow-up. And our first follow-up item is, let's talk about Teslas, and let's talk about superchargers and charging at night.
Now you're following instructions. This is another thing, by the way, that the chat room was also the chat room was also right about this last show. We just didn't get a chance to pull them. I meant to do it, but we had moved on by then. In the discussion about how many supercharger stations there are versus how many gas stations, and factoring how long it takes to charge, and all the other infrastructure needed if we were to convert all of the existing cars to electric with a snap of our fingers, and so on and so forth. One point we didn't bring up, but again, which the chat room did, was that even though superchargers take a long time to charge, you can fill up your electric car someplace other than the quote unquote gas station. You know, when you drive it back to your house, you just plug it in. And a lot of people were saying that as long as you don't drive more than half the range of your car per day, you never need to go to a supercharger unless you're going on a long trip. So you need far fewer superchargers because just when you go back home, you plug it in. And I was thinking about this when I was discussing the charging thing last time, and it's kind of in the middle because, I mean, well, Marco can tell us, but like I recall him saying somewhere on Twitter that it takes like 3 days to charge his car to full capacity from the plain old wall outlet.
Yeah, so if you only have a plain old wall outlet, it's about 3 days for a full charge. But if you're spending this much on a car, I don't think it's that much to ask to spend another few hundred to at most a couple thousand dollars to do whatever it takes to get a high powered outlet in your garage. If you have a 50 amp outlet, the NEMA 1450 that Tesla recommends, that charges the entire car in something like 7 hours, depending on how big a battery you have.
So if you're buying a $70,000 or $80,000 or $35,000 car, maybe, but as these things come down in price, like basically I would say if you're asking people to change their home in some way, they basically become like a little charging station. Like that's part of the infrastructure. Part of the infrastructure, you don't have to build gas stations, but every single person who owns one of these cars has to at least have a dryer outlet in their garage or buy one of the big supercharger things or whatever, which is fine, like you said, for people with Model S and the Model 3.
Well, not every person. Like, you know, underscore, our friend underscore David Smith, he is still, you know, he bought the car like in December. He still just only has the regular outlet, and he drives few enough miles that it doesn't really matter unless he's taking a trip, in which case he's using superchargers. So, and right now I still have that too, because electricians in New York take a while to get back to you. So I still have the plain old outlet as well, and so far it's been totally fine because I'm not driving hundreds of miles a day. It would only be a problem if I was driving like, you know, 100 or more miles a day.
What I'm getting at is like that it's not that the math is not as long as you drive half the range. It's more like if you drive a third of the range or whatever. And the other thing is that since these are the first round of like minimally viable electric cars to compete with gas cars, they don't have the same range as a long range gas car, but they're close enough that, you know, that it's fine. Right. This is not like the Leaf where it's intended to be a very short range car. I would assume that the capacity of electric cars will go up as batteries become cheaper. Maybe not that much. Maybe they'll stop around a 300 mile range, like an easy 300 mile range for everybody. And so that will just only add to charging time. So it seems like some necessary part of the infrastructure of the electric car world is every home to have a little bit better charging capacity. Doesn't mean they need to have a big supercharger or the $3,000 thing or whatever. Probably just an extra dryer outlet. And since most people, I would imagine, go way less than a third of the range of their electric car or even a quarter of the range of electric car, they'll probably be fine. And that will definitely save on the supercharger, the number of superchargers needed. The flip side of that, though, is that the places that need superchargers are going to need a lot of them. So along Interstate 90, where there's nobody else in the entire world, everybody is stopping somewhere along Interstate 90. I mean, if all the cars were electric, no one is going across New York State. You know, you got to stop for your gas somewhere if you're going from, like, you know, Boston to Buffalo or something. And it's just a giant corridor of a bunch of cars that need to do that. And they're used to pulling off at one of the service stations, getting gas, you know, and then just continuing on. And if it takes you even just 15 minutes, that's going to, you know, you're going to have big backups and snarls. As you can tell, if anything at all goes wrong at any of the toll stations along the way, that you're just sitting in traffic for hours and hours. So it seems like superchargers are going to be concentrated along the major thoroughfares. And then in suburban areas, maybe you can have one that covers a tremendous area because only people who are passing through need it. Everyone else just charges at their house.
Well, also, I think another major problem to tackle is that if you don't have a house with a garage or a permanent parking spot and a driveway, it's kind of impractical to have an electric car because you have, like, you know, so many people live in apartments or street parking only areas where you're parking your car on the street overnight. You know, you don't have a driveway, you don't have a garage. How do you charge, you know, on a regular basis out there? That's trickier to solve, I think.
Inductive charging mats. You just drive your car over the top of it.
Those exist.
You never know.
I know. They'll just put them in the road when they're putting the little sensors for these automated cars. They'll also put chargers at every stoplight.
Yeah, why not? Marco, what's the nearest supercharger to you in terms of distance?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, there's one in Newburgh, but that's, which is pretty far up. I mean, it depends on, like, you know, what direction am I headed is the more relevant question. If I'm going upstate, the closest one is Newburgh, which is something like a half hour up or an hour up. If I'm going, you know, into Pennsylvania, New Jersey area, then I'm sure it's a different one. If I'm going through Connecticut, I think there's a couple over there. So it depends on where I'm going, really.
Yeah, the reason I'm asking is, I see there's one in Greenwich, Connecticut, which looks to my eye like it's pretty close to you.
Yeah, that's very close.
There's one in Paramus, New Jersey, which also looks fairly mm-hmm. close, although it looks like Greenwich is probably closer.
It is.
And anyway, the what I'm driving at, though, is let's suppose for the sake of discussion that you don't ever do anything to the home and you only have a regular outlet and you would have to charge over the span of 3 days. In a desperation scenario, you could drive what to my eye looks like half an hour or less to, say, Greenwich, and you could use a supercharger there and drive back. And that's what, like probably 20, 30 miles, maybe a little more, maybe a little less. And that would, in a pinch, solve the problem as long as you had an hour to spare.
Right.
To go charge.
I always have an hour for Greenwich. They have amazing watch stores there and a good lunch place.
Oh, my God. How's the chicken salad?
I haven't had that yet.
Fair enough. But anyway, but you see what I'm driving at is, you know, maybe...
I haven't been there that many times.
Maybe you can avoid doing the home modification until the next time you do, you know, demo on the house, which for you seems to be every couple of years.
Yeah, but, right. But, you know, I have one of those situations, like I think like underscore, where my circuit breaker panel is full. And so the electrician's quoting me a couple $1,000 to do like a, I don't need a panel upgrade, but I need a sub panel. And then once you throw in the cost of all the local permits and everything else, all the fees for the town and everything, it's probably going to be maybe $2,000 or $3,000. And that does make you pause and like, well, is that really? Am I really ever going to need that necessarily compared to the regular outlet? And I might not.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I find this all fascinating. I don't suspect that I'm going to have an electric car anytime soon. Not necessarily from lack of desire, but because those that are available today don't really do it for me, or are exorbitantly expensive, or are the Model 3 that even if I reserve one now, I won't get until Declan's graduating college. So I don't suspect I'm going to get an electric car anytime soon, but I am fascinated by all the differences and the different thoughts and concerns and worries that one has. Like, should I modify my home in order to support charging this quicker? That's so different than what I'm used to thinking about. And I just find it very interesting.
I mean, and in all fairness, the modification to your home, if your home is at all modern or new or has modern electric service in it, is usually very minimal. It's usually a couple $100 to have an electrician install a high power outlet, usually really close to where your breaker was anyway, because so many breakers are in garages. So it's, you know, for most homes out there in the country that are fairly young, I think it would be a very inexpensive modification, and most people I don't think really think too much about it.
Yeah. All right, moving on. Well, sort of moving on. John, do you want to tell us about this next item?
Yeah, I meant to look up what SAE stands for, but one of you and or the chat room will do that while I'm addressing one last point on the superchargers. Also brought up by the chat room, also related to SAE, which is connector standards. Tesla's apparently got its own connector.
Mm-hmm.
It's got like the two little things. Does it have like a T-shape in it? I seem to remember it had like a kind of a branding theme. But anyway.
Yeah, I think there's four pins in there, maybe.
Society of Automotive Engineers, SAE stands for. They have a standard connector for electric cars, which is not the same as the Tesla connector. So, I mean, we'll see how this works out in terms of, you know, adapters don't seem like it's rocket science if you have any kind of station that can provide electricity to cars. Obviously, Tesla has its own brand of supercharger stations. They don't care if you can charge anyone else's car there, I think, but I see no reason why they couldn't. I feel like that will work itself out. If it turns out that Tesla builds a million supercharger stations before anybody builds anything, guess what? The standard connector is Tesla's, not this SAE standard. But speaking of SAE standards, SAE has a standard measurement system for self-driving cars, which why wouldn't they? Because they're sitting around all day trying to come up with standards like, ooh, self-driving cars. I bet we can make up standards for things that don't exist. So they did. It goes from 0 to 5. 0 is no automation and 5 is full automation. And they divide it into two regions of 3 each because they start from 0 because they're programmers. 0, 1, and 2 is human driver monitors drive engagement. Basically, there needs to be a human driver and they need to monitor everything. And 3, 4, and 5 is automated driving system monitors driving environment. I didn't read this entire PDF, so I'm not quite sure how they break it down much farther. But again, my criteria is, do I need to know how to drive a car to get into this car? I guess you could do it simpler as, do I get to sit in the back seat? Because that boils down to the same thing. If you get to sit in the back seat and no one is in the front seat, that's complete self-driving car, right?
Right. Can I fall asleep?
Yeah. If you have to sit in the front seat and have to know how to drive a car because you may be called upon to do so, you're still in the lower range. So that's really the barrier that I carry. But it's good that the Society of Automotive Engineers has decided to come up with a scale for this. And I wonder where they would... I mean, I guess your Tesla is on 2, which they call partial automation. It's like no automation, driver assistance, partial automation, conditional automation, high automation, full automation. Oh, standards bodies. Is there anything you can't standardize? Apparently not. So anyway, be watching for SAE numbers to be quoted on your cars, just like the SAE engine power ratings that no one reads.
Except you.
Mm-hmm. All right. John, do you think, and this is Robin Malhotra that's asked us this, do you think, John, that Apple's new file system or truly autonomous vehicles will come first?
Truly autonomous, according to my definition just laid out, as in you can sit in the back seat and don't have to drive, Apple's file system will come first, easily.
I tend to agree, but you never really know. All right. Cameron Palm has written in and made some interesting points about the Amazon Echo and Amazon in general. He or she has said, while I'm sure Amazon Echo and Dash buttons are interesting as products, there are a couple of key issues. Number one, Amazon is a U.S. thing. It works in the U.S. because of cheap shipping. It doesn't work slash exist in most of the world, including Europe, not in the U.S. sense. The Echo is also only available in American English. Siri, on the other hand, and he or she provides a link, is available in many, many, many places. And there's a link that we'll put in the show notes for future availability for Siri.
This happens a lot when we bring up things. I forget, maybe Netflix was another one. A lot of things that we don't realize are U.S.-centric or U.S. only. So if there are other people listening in the U.S. and who are just thinking, oh, Amazon, everyone has Amazon, right? Apparently a lot of the stuff Amazon does is really confined to the U.S. in ways that you wouldn't imagine it would be. Because, like, is there anything specific about the Echo that has to be so U.S.? It seems like they could make one for other countries, right? Maybe they just don't have enough server farms over there. They don't have the expertise to do the translation and the detection in different languages. Either way, it's always seemed kind of weird to me that such a big company like Amazon seems to have such grand ambitions with the whole, you know, EC2 and S3 and selling things all over the world. I mean, I can understand maybe not being able to sell physical goods all over the world, but for all their electronic products and network services, they should expand more.
Well, and I think this is I think we're seeing here a strategy tax at Amazon, which is the Echo does lots of things that don't use their services, their storefronts at all, and don't depend on their storefronts at all. But one of the main reasons that all Amazon hardware exists is to get you to buy more content or media or stuff from Amazon. And so I bet they don't want to even bother supporting it in countries and languages where they also don't have widespread store coverage for their stores. And Amazon is historically notoriously U.S.-centric in their storefronts. So that's probably the reason, the main reason why, is that the Echo couldn't do like half the things that Amazon wants it to be doing.
Yeah, maybe, but like you have to just think like long term. Like, I mean, because Amazon, like I said, Amazon is such a long term thinking company. I mean, the CEO is making spaceships and stuff. So long term, if you're not selling in China, you've got a big problem, because China has a lot of, and India for that matter. China and India, guess what? They have a lot of people, and those people are in many cases crawling up into the income class where they can buy your products. Like that. Those countries are, they're not developing countries, they're like developed, like, you know, they're entering the middle class type of thing. They're ready to buy expensive frivolous electronics, right? And it's happening faster and faster. So like, if you, no matter how, I put it this way, even if Amazon gets 100% of the market for physical goods in the United States, if you just fast forward enough years, whoever gets 100% of the market in China and India is going to gobble them up. Because having 100% of the U.S. is meaningless when they get billions of people in Asia.
Yep. All right. Who wants to talk about Ubiquiti's 8-port Power over Ethernet switch?
Probably Marco.
Our first sponsor this week. are we really going to talk about a switch?
I am, briefly. Go ahead, sponsor. You're fine.
Our first sponsor this week is Meh.com. This is a new sponsor. It's Meh. Am I pronouncing that right? M-E-H? Meh?
Meh.
I've never actually said this word.
You have to sound more apathetic.
Meh.
You got it.
That's better. That's better.
So meh.com, these are the people. Long ago, they founded a site called Woot.com. And Woot was like a one thing a day, daily deal kind of site. And the things were like things that appealed to geeks. So it was, you know, like cheap, crappy little hardware. Like what? And what I was saying last week and the week before, like just being blown away by how cheap hardware is these days. And it especially costs nothing if you get it from a place like Meh. So what they do is one deal a day. And this is how Amazon ruined it. So Amazon bought Woot forever ago. The team behind it, the founders behind it, eventually got fed up because Amazon was ruining it. They made it, instead of being one deal a day, it would be, oh, now there's just a whole bunch of deals. And so, well, that's kind of just Amazon at that point. It kind of lost its personality and kind of lost what made it special. So they were all unhappy with this, so they just left. And they went and founded a company called Mediocre Labs, which I love, and they made this site called Meh. And I love the attitude at this site. If you read their copy, this is like the best copywriting for trying to just barely sell a product. For this ad, there's no coupon code, there's no tracking URL, I was given no script, they just said just wing it. If you see like they sponsored Daring Fireball a lot, you can almost barely tell that they are sponsoring. Like the way they want those posts to be written, like it almost seems like, wait, who's the sponsor here? They like hide the link. They do like fun kind of like quirky stuff like that, because this is obviously like laid back people who know that they are selling really cheap hardware, and it's like surprisingly cheap. So today, the one on there today is, it looks kind of like an Apple Watch shape, but it's actually a speaker that goes on your wrist. It's like, who would wear this? And they even say like, who would wear this? And it's $8, and that's today. And it changes every day. It changes at midnight. Once the things sell out, they're just gone. That's it. There's no like advance notice of like, hey, tomorrow we're gonna have a Chromebook or whatever. And sometimes they, you know, so they have all this like awesome like cheap, crappy hardware that like, you can't believe it's that cheap and it has anything in it that works. And they also sometimes have good stuff. Like they had last week, they had a really impressive home theater receiver that does 3D sound, which I didn't even know this was a thing until I read their site. They had Apple Watch on there before, the Apple Watch Sport on there a few weeks back or a few months back. They have some really nice stuff as well. I love their copywriting more than anything else. I love how they sell these products just barely. The attitude is hilarious. It's, you can like sign up to become a special member, which is the very mediocre person, VMP, not VIP. There's all sorts of little benefits you can get here. Check it out. It's meh.com, meh.com, meh.
That's pretty much spot on.
Okay, good. I feel like I need more facial hair to say it correctly.
No, you just need a lot of indifference. You need to be overflowing with indifference.
This is a hard ad read to do, because usually I'm supposed to sound enthusiastic about the sponsors.
Not this time.
I love the way these people do business. So check it out, meh.com. Thanks for sponsoring.
Meh.
There we go. That's how I'm supposed to say it.
So why don't we talk about this 8-port power over Ethernet switch.
I'm right
at the edge of my seat. I'm so excited.
Well, last week I was talking about me trying to find just a simple 8-port switch that has no fan, is silent, is reliable, and you know, just sits there. My other requirement, by the way, is that the power and the ports be on the same side. Just because of the way I have these various switches arranged, it's kind of annoying to have the kind that are meant to be in a rack where the ports are on the front but the power comes in the back. Because that's just not a good arrangement for things that are sitting on the edge of a table or something. Anyway, and Marco brought up and linked to his the HP thing that he likes. And actually, I saved a bookmark for that. And next time I need one, I'm going to give that one to try. I still have a couple of extras at home waiting for them to die. But once they die, I'll try that one.
Well, also, if you just need one big one, I actually use a rack mount HP switch in my garage that has it. Because when we had our big renovations done, I had the house wired for Ethernet. So I have something like 12 or 15 ports that all go into this big HP. I think it's an 1810, something like that. So that's probably, yeah, something like that. It's some kind of gigabit HP semi-managed or managed switch. It was a couple $100, and that's also been rock solid. I've never like rebooted that, never had a port die, never had any problems with it whatsoever.
Yeah, if I had it in like a garage or in the basement or someplace like that, I would just get a big rack mount one and just put it wherever the heck I wanted it, and who would care as long as it was reliable. But unfortunately, due to the way I have the wires running, I have lots of these little ones around. I have an 8-port one on my TV. I have an 8.1 in the computer room. I have an 8.1 next to my NAS and stuff downstairs. And so there's a bunch of these little ones, many of which are in spaces where people have to be, so they have to be quiet. So the HP one, it's fanless. If it's reliable, you know, I'll give it a try. That sounds good. But I was surprised that Marco didn't suggest Ubiquiti, because we talked about Ubiquiti Harbor last week, and you were saying how much you loved it. They make an 8-port switch too. And Ars Technica actually reviewed it recently, and it looks weird and enterprisey and Ubiquiti and stuff like that. But I'm like, hey, well, if it's solid and reliable, it's exactly what you're looking for, right? This is a fanless one. Their 8-port one doesn't have any fans in it. It has a bunch of fancy features that I'm not interested in, like the, you know, all these things it can do with traffic shaping and, you know, management and all sorts of other stuff. But of course, it's $200. So I pretty much noped out of that once I saw the price. Not that I'm completely unwilling to pay a lot of, because, you know, most of the time it's like, all right, well, if this is a good one and it's reliable, I'll pay money for it. But just, it's just so much more than like the $50 I'm used to paying. And it's like, well, if you keep buying $50 switches, you're going to get a crappy one and they're going to make noise and go dead or whatever. But the thing is, I had these D-Link switches that were attractive and reliable for a really long time, like 6 years, 7 years, maybe. No, it's got to be longer than that. It's at least 8 years. That's how old my Mac is, and I think I got them before that. And I just want that again. You know, maybe I just got lucky and I found, like, it was, I think I bought them for like $35 like 8 years ago. I just want that again. 8 years for $35 is much better than, you know, how long would a $200 thing need to last? So anyway, I think I am not in the market for these Ubiquiti switches, but who knows? Maybe I'll get burned by enough $30 boxes that I will regret not buying this fancy managed 8-port switch from the fancy Marco brand.
Yeah, and also, you know, a little more follow-up on Ubiquiti before we leave so we stop getting email about it. Apparently, Ubiquiti also sells IP cameras. And I did look very briefly into those, but Amazon didn't stock a lot of them. It looks like they're transitioning their model line into a new model that's, like, out of stock everywhere right now. So I kind of just missed it. So that's why I didn't look into that. They're also a little more money, and also a few people wrote in to say that they also now have... I was talking last week about how there's this annoying Java wireless access point-based controller software that you need if you have certain advanced features enabled, which I don't, you also need it for initial setup of any of their wireless access points. And it turns out that they also sell this little kind of like one of those like Intel USB... It looks like a USB stick, but it's actually like a whole mini computer in there. You know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. Little, are they the NUCs, is that? Whatever those are. They sell something that looks just like that, and it runs their software in this little like mini computer thing. So you don't need to run it on one of your real computers if you don't want to. But those things are also sold out everywhere. But when they're in stock, they're supposed to only be like $70 or $80. So you can pay $70 or $80 to avoid installing Java somewhere, which I would probably do.
And what was the name of that product? Do you remember?
I have no idea. It doesn't matter because it's out of stock everywhere. It's Ubiquiti. It's like some kind of like cloud controller or something like that.
Interesting. All right.
Ubiquiti makes routers and Wi-Fi access points and IP cameras and switches.
They also make long-range Wi-Fi antennas. So, like, if you want to like beam Wi-Fi from one building to a whole different building that might be far away, they make a whole bunch of stuff to do that. That also costs suspiciously little, but everyone says works very well.
It's like this company is everywhere.
Yeah, well, I think they, you know, it turns out there's a pretty big business in taking something that's controlled by a very small number of very high margin companies and doing the same thing for a lot less money.
I'm glad Casey got my joke.
Yeah.
I'm here for you.
Thank you.
All right, so right after we recorded the last episode, Smile Software ended up...
Just Smile now.
Changing yep. Some of the stuff about the new pricing for Text Expander. What it basically amounted to was, well, most of the things are the same. We're going to give you a little bit of a discount if you're already a customer, and we'll keep the old thing around for some undetermined amount of time. Is that a relatively fair summary?
Well, I think the most important thing is that they did something, because that was what we were talking about last week. Like, oh, let's see what they did. Let's think maybe they meant this, maybe they meant that, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, all right, well, we see what their announcement of Text Expander 6 is doing to the market. Now we wait to see, is this what they wanted to do? Because a lot of the discussion last show was like, well, this is what they did, and it doesn't seem crazy to expect to have these results come out of it. Surely they must have thought of this. But on the other hand, maybe they've made a huge mistake, and we'll find out if they do anything about it. Like, oh, no, no, we hear your feedback. We're going to, and that's exactly what they did. It was faster than I ever thought they would. So it's so clear that whatever it is they thought they were doing, they did not expect the reaction they got, because there was, what was it, like 2 days after the announcement? One day? It was very quickly afterwards. They have this post that says, no, all right, we heard your feedback, blah, blah, blah. And then we come to the announcement. Did they hear people's feedback? Yeah. Is what they've done actually addressing people's concerns? And I don't know, I'll let Marco say, because I know he has a pretty strong opinion that they're not addressing the concerns, really.
Well, it's, you know, I mean, honestly, I don't care that strongly about this topic in general, because, as I said, I'm not really a Text Expander user. And also, I am a developer who sells something that's subscription priced. And so I do sympathize with their economic needs here. However, you know, what they announced is basically that, you know, they moved this product that was a traditionally sold, like, you pay $40 or something for this product. Every time you do a major upgrade, you might get an upgrade discount or whatever. But for the most part, it's like you pay a decent amount up front, and then you can use it as long as you want. And then when we make new ones every couple of years or every year, you can choose to upgrade or not. And they moved it from that model to, it's now a web service with a required $5 a month subscription with these client apps that are now free. And so the people who used it were very angry for basically two main reasons. Number one, as we discussed last episode, a lot of people just don't like subscription pricing, especially for things that they don't expect it on or that they don't see the value in. Whether or not it's there, you know, it's what people expect for pricing models. Whether, you know, like, I don't want to pay per month for, like, a USB hub. It's just a USB hub. It does its job, right? Why should I need to pay per month for that? Some people view software that way, even though it kind of isn't in practice. But anyway, so there was that complaint. And if you have that complaint, the new announcement, which is basically, we are dropping the price on the subscription for people who had the old version, and we're going to keep the old version updated for an unspecified amount of time. And so if you had the objection that this thing should not be subscription priced, period, this will not affect you at all. You will still be upset about this. If you had the opinion that, well, I'm upset about this not because it's subscription priced, but because I will end up paying a lot more than I did before, then this will probably make you happy, because now it has removed, I think, most or all of that complaint. I haven't done all the numbers, but it's something like, you know, I think you'll end up paying roughly the same that you were paying before if you upgraded every few years. So it will address some of the complaints, the ones that were primarily about just like total price over time. But it will not address the people who are really upset that they are moving to this model. And also, they also have this other problem where they removed their sync features. Because one of the ways they're justifying the new subscription service is you can now sync through their web service. In fact, you have to sync through their web service. Before, Text Expander, which works by having full keyboard access, so it can read every keystroke, it has to read every keystroke you're typing. So it is functionally a keylogger. And before, it didn't need internet access, because before it supported sync through lots of different means. Basically, like, it would store its data in a file somewhere, and you could sync that file through many different means. I think Dropbox was probably the most common one that people used from people who I know who used it. So before, this keylogger effectively didn't need network access. Now it does. And so there's also the concerns about it, you know, the security around this. You know, it's kind of tricky to combine something that has full keylogging access with something that has a network connection to third-party servers that you don't control. And then there's a question around whether they are encrypting the snippets that you are storing there. And of course, the answer, I'm pretty sure the answer is that they're not, but they're just relying on the other security measures around just like your login and stuff to protect them. So there's a whole bunch of concerns here that people had, a whole bunch of objections that people had to this new model, and they have addressed one of them, which is the total price over time. But that's all they've addressed so far.
What about Text Expander 5? Their change on that said, we will continue, this is from their press release, we will continue to sell and support Text Expander 5 for OS 10 and Text Expander 3 plus custom keyboard for iOS for those who need it. And they don't give any time scales. We will continue to sell and support, continue for how long? Forever? A year, a month, a week, 5 days. When, if Text Expander 5 is not compatible for the next version of OS 10, will it be updated? So many questions that, again, I have to think, they know these questions. Like, they've been getting tons and tons of feedbacks. Huge number of those questions must have said, how long will Text Expander 5 be supported? Will you update it? How long will how long will your old versions that didn't do the subscription pricing, how long will they be supported? Will you continue to update them? And they just didn't answer it at all. And you have to think it's because they think people won't like the answer, not because, oh, it didn't occur to us to address that question, because they must have got that question thousands of times already.
Yeah, because the answer is, you know, if you think about it, just think about it from their point of view. They're not trying to be like greedy or evil or anything. They can't support an old version of this app forever. There's going to be, on an infinite timescale, there's going to be an end to the support for this version of this app. So, and, you know, when are they going to do that? What they've said in this post, it really just, I think, honestly makes the problem a little bit worse, because it implies that this will be supported indefinitely. But, you know, in practice, there's going to be an end, and I don't think we or they know when that end will be yet, but I think they're creating an unmaintainable expectation here.
Yeah, like, if to the naive person reading this, someone's going to read, "We will continue to sell and support Text Expander 5," and be like, "Oh, I'm so satisfied. This press release made me feel so much better. Thank you, Smile. We love you," right? But what they have in their head is, "And I'll continue to use Text Expander 5 forever." Like, and eventually, Text Expander 5 will not work, and they're going to be so angry then, because they're going to be like, "But you put out this press release that said you will continue to sell and support Text Expander 5, and then that's going to be like, "Well, we continue to support Text Expander 5, but unfortunately, Text Expander 5 is a product that is only compatible with versions X, Y, and Z, and blah, blah, blah." And it'll be like, "But you said," and like, people aren't reading like lawyers. They're not reading for the nuance. They're not, and they don't know. Like, why should you expect a customer to understand what is involved in maintaining an application across multiple releases of various OSs? Like, there is some, especially for like a system-wide utility like Text Expander, whether it's on iOS or on OS 10, there's always going to be stuff you have to do to maintain it. It's not as simple as just a standalone application that you just run it and then it quits. Even that needs to be maintained. So I don't know if they're setting themselves up for failure, but like, if I think about how much do I think they're going to support Text Expander 5? Well, they don't want to support two different versions of their product. Like, who would want, like, the whole point of the, they want to have sustainable development. There's a whole bunch of subscription pricing. You can't say, okay, now we're going to have two teams, one that's just maintaining the old versions and one's maintaining the new version. Nobody wants to do that. So my gut reaction as someone who's seen a lot of software is that Text Expander 5 and Text Expander 3 for iOS, they'll probably work with this version of OS 10 and the next, and this version of iOS and the next version probably. But when they break, I don't think Smile will invest too much in fixing them, because they'll be like, "Look, you had your time. Now it's time to move on to the other one." To whatever, 6 or 7 or whatever they're up to now.
Right. And in Smile's defense, you know, this is why, like, I don't want to, like, gang up on them or be, you know, or attribute malice to them, but there are these problems with every way you choose to take money. You know, if they continue doing the old way of, here's a paid app, you buy it once, and then in a couple years you might buy an upgrade, that method also has to cut off support for old versions eventually, and when that happens, that also angers people. And so no matter what you do, no matter where you choose to take money, it will anger somebody, and you know, a lot of somebodies, if you have a good customer base, you know, if you have a good sized customer base, it's going to anger a lot of people regardless of what you do. If you don't charge for anything, that'll anger people who are afraid that you're going to sell their data. If you put ads in, that'll anger people who don't like ads, who don't like what they're doing. No matter what you do, you're going to anger people. I don't envy the position that Smile's in here, because what they're clearly saying, if not, you know, directly then implying, what they're clearly saying is, we need to get more money from Text Expander. Like, whatever, this isn't working for us, we need more revenue from it somehow. And the way we're going to do that is going to have this short-term pain for somebody. And it seems like they're trying to address people's concerns, but ultimately they're not able to. They can't, because they have to make money somewhere. So, like, there's always going to be people who are mad about this, and they're going to have to choose to make some of them mad. I think the only two good options here are either that they continue doing the subscription model, which honestly I don't think is a good idea. It seems deeply flawed for the kind of product it is and the kind of audience that it had, as far as I know. But again, I'm not them. I don't know who their customers are, so I could be wrong. So that's one option, is to just go whole hog in the subscriptions the way they were before, and just be honest, like, "Look, you know, support for 5 will end after next OS 10 version," or something like that. You know, set a date or set a version where it'll just say, "All right, it'll stop after this, and then you're on your own, and you got to move to our service now or not." Or completely bring back the old model of licensing. Whether they continue doing the subscription model also or not, I don't know. But, you know, the alternative here is you bring back the old model where, okay, now, you know, Text Expander 6 is a regular software release that you can buy for $40 or whatever, and you can own it with no monthly fees after that for, you know, until you decide to stop using it or until it breaks with some distant future OS 10 version. I don't see another option here. Like, what they're doing now is trying to bridge the benefits of both. They're trying to please people who want both without giving up their subscription idea. And because, you know, this is obviously, like, they've obviously invested a lot into setting this up, migrating their product over to this kind of system. Somebody's using it. So if they kill the subscription service now, they're going to anger the people who are using it and who do like it. So, like, this is not an enviable position to be in. I don't want to make light of this because, you know, as I said, like, this is all hard stuff. And in the current software landscape, it is incredibly difficult to make a healthy profit selling software today. It's just hard. And they have a staff they have to support. And, you know, you can argue, oh, well, maybe software should be free, or maybe there's a lot of competition, or maybe they should lower their costs or whatever. But none of those things are easy things to address or easy things to actually follow through on, and often have uncomfortable side effects. So this is not, you know, the solution might just be, like, it's kind of like when the minimum wage goes up. Yeah, I'm sorry for going political here.
Oh, God.
When the minimum wage goes up, one of the problems that economists cite when that happens is it basically prices out a whole bunch of jobs from being doable. Because, like, well, now, like, if the minimum I have to pay a legal full-time employee is X, then any job that costs less than X, just kind of, I just can't pay somebody to do that, really. Or any job that's only worth, you know, something below X. That kind of problem happens now with software, which is, like, a lot of software that could be created and that could have value to people just is not going to do well enough in the market, or people won't pay enough for it to be sustained. So a lot of that software just won't get created, or it will get created and then get abandoned. So there's all sorts of, like, you know, economic uncomfortable truths about this. However you think about software pricing, however you think things should be priced, or whatever you're willing to pay for them, it's a very tricky area, and I don't envy Smile at all for the position they're in right now.
Yeah, I certainly don't either.
Yeah, like, I kind of think of, like, Adobe when they went through a similar transition of, like, I think Adobe was making plenty of money, but they said, you know what, we think it would be better for us financially if you could pay for our applications on a subscription basis rather than us selling you a box with software in it or selling you a download or whatever. And for the most part, they made a transition to that. And Microsoft is going through the same thing now, trying to sell Office 365 subscriptions and everything like that. Smile, obviously, is much smaller than Adobe or Microsoft, looked like it was trying to make a similar transition. And it's almost like, I feel like, ripping off the Band-Aid and just plowing bravely forward. Certainly from the outside, that would be a cleaner situation. But from the inside, it may be like, no, that wasn't even an option. Like, we would have died. The product would not be viable. We tried it. It's not working. Too many people are angry. We're not selling enough subscriptions. We have to immediately do an about face. And so, I guess, you know, better now than 6 months from now or whatever. But anyway, this is surely not the way they hoped this transition would go. And I think their attempt to fix it with the discount and the vague promise of support for the old versions, I don't know if it makes it worse, but boy, like, I don't know if it gives them a higher chance of success either. Like, I just feel like they're signing that all they've done is deferred the anger to a later period.
Yeah.
The discount, I think is probably fine, because I think a discount is actually, like, maybe the mistake they just made was making the subscription price too high. That could have been something they decided to, oh, we're getting all this angry feedback, we're not selling enough subscriptions. Again, I'm speculating here. Maybe the price is just too high. Like, if you told people they could use Text Expander, you get it for free and you have to pay a penny a month, everyone's fine with that. Suddenly it's not some sort of philosophical objection to subscription pricing. I don't want to pay a penny a month. It's too much. No, everybody's fine with that. It's below their level of concern, right? But $5 a month or whatever it is was above people's, you know, so the 50% discount for life, if that brings it down below people's threshold, then we'll see. Like Marco said, do they really object philosophically to subscriptions, period? Or is it merely that the price is too high? The promise for Text Expander is like, and also, we're not even really sure the subscription thing is a good idea, so you can have this thing for some undefined period of time, but probably it will go away, but you probably don't know that. And Oh, it just makes me depressed. But, you know, anyway, we'll see how it works out for them. Like Marco said, this is difficult. But the final part is you can't get your way out of a press release without something terrible appearing. And I feel like it's, I'm not a PR person. I don't know how to do a PR person's job. I'm not going to say that I could have written this better. But as someone who reads a lot of press releases, reading this does not make me feel better about the company, and I imagine that's what press releases are supposed to do. The last part of it was, this is supposed to be like, you know, person to person, like, have empathy for us, so on and so forth. This was a big change, and there were a number of things we could have done better. All right, this sounds like the start of a paragraph where they're saying basically, like, acknowledging, okay, our bad, you know, you are angry at us, and we have to, at this point, acknowledge that you are angry at us with reasons. There are things that didn't turn out the way we wanted them to. You know, we're sorry, you're mad, we acknowledge your anger, like that, right? Seems like it's going fine so far. We genuinely want to bring you the best text expander experience we can. Unfortunately, not all of accents had the intended effect. Still good so far. For example, we staggered our customer emails over 3 days to ensure smooth server capacity so that everyone would have a good initial experience with the service. The server held up, but many customers learned of the new text expander from news sites, Twitter rather than from Smile. That is not an example of the bad things that people are yelling at you about. Like, because they found out the news from a site other than you, as if somehow if they found out from you, they would have choked it down and it would have been more palatable. They're angry about what happened. Finding out what happened from news sites rather than from you, there's a component of that. Maybe you're like, why do I got to hear this on Twitter instead of from you directly, Smile? But substantively, if you're going to pick the thing that people are angry about, that's not it. This whole press release was addressing their issues, none of which were, I found out about this from Twitter instead of Smile. Don't end your press release like that. It's like, you know, what is your greatest weakness? Oh, I'm a little bit, you know, I'm such a hard worker sometimes, or I'm too honest. You know, like, that's not, they were so close, they were right there. But for example, and the example they gave is not what people are angry. It's not even in like the top three that people are angry about. So close.
Yeah, I have a feeling the story is not over.
Yeah, we've heard you, and actually it's going to be 25% of the original price for life, and Text Expander 5 will be supported indefinitely, and we're canceling Text Expander 6, but wait, we heard you, Text Expander 6 users, you want to keep... All right, I give them one. Yeah, you know, they're allowed to... You try something, doesn't work, you react fast, good. If they come back again with another press release, then we're just going to have a dedicated Text Expander podcast, I guess.
Oh, God. All right. Well, we have one more quick piece of follow-up, and then we can move on to some other stuff.
These weren't the topics?
They were. We're in that gray area.
It's not gray area. Text Expander is follow-up.
So is Apple.
Yeah, fair enough. John, you finally got your wish. You got your bleeps and bloops. And how's that going?
Not my wish. I wanted a bleeps and bloops theme song that we had in one episode way back when. But Marco took it upon itself to add bleeps and bloops before and after the ads, I think because he listens to too much Hello Internet or some other reason. But anyway, we've gotten a lot of feedback about that, and I thought Marco should explain what he's doing and why.
We've gotten like three people who don't like that.
It's more than that, but man, the people who don't like it.
I mean, I can say the sky is blue, and more people will tell me I'm an idiot and wrong than what we've heard about this.
Well, that's also true.
Well, people don't like change, so that's obvious, right? But what I'm more interested in is, why did you add them? Not why do people not like them, but why did you add them?
Sure. So first of all, you can quibble over the choice of sounds. I chose old Mac sounds. I wanted to do the Windows XP USB device plugged in and unplugged sounds, but I knew John would not allow that. That's correct, John?
I don't even know that sound, but no, that would be
it's
terrible.
Like, boo-doom.
No Windows.
Okay. Anyway, so that's what I wanted to do, and I knew John would object, so I chose old Mac sounds instead. That kind of just the actual origins of them are kind of funny. One of them's a crash and one of them's a reboot of some old Macs. I didn't pick based on what computers they belong to specifically in the old Apple lineup. I just picked based on which ones I thought sounded right for this purpose. I was thinking about using something like this for a while because it allows me a lot more flexibility in editing of when I start the ad and when I end the ad. It also saves time in the episode because it removes all the transition lead-in from, like, Casey saying, all right, before we cover this, Marco, why don't you tell me something that's awesome? You know, something like that. Like, it removes the need for a lot of that. So it does save time, I think. And it's also just gives me the flexibility to place the ads wherever I want, really. Like, wherever there's a natural break in conversation, even if we didn't say at that point in the show, All right, let's do a sponsor break now. So it allows flexibility in editing, basically, and it makes everything shorter. It also helps differentiate when the ad has begun and when the ad has ended.
It forces you to figure that out, too, which is not always easy.
Yeah, it forces it to be like a firmly defined boundary, which I think is better editorially, even though I think we were pretty good about that already. But this does help just a little bit. Like last week, you talked, John, about Blue Apron after I had finished doing my script. And so if I wanted to integrate that into the ad read, I had to move it in. And I did. And so I actually rearranged the ending of the ad to move that into the ad read like explicitly. And then once the sound played, the ad was over. So I think that helped also. So that's why I did it. And the reason I started 2 weeks ago is because all three live reads I did that recording, I hated them all. And so I recorded them all the next morning. And when I do a recording after the fact, which I occasionally do if I mess up a read too badly or if I just don't like the way it turned out, I will, of course, always sound slightly different from the way I sounded the night before, just because, you know, people's voices change throughout the day. And you know, and throughout each day, you might have different voice today than yesterday by, you know, just how tired you are, whether you're sick, whether there's allergies, whatever. So I didn't like all three of the ads I did 2 weeks ago. I replaced them all the morning after and decided this would be a good time to use these sounds because it would help people not notice that I sounded different in the ads. And these did, as far as I know, these did originate, like the idea of ad bumper sounds, I first heard it on Hello Internet. I don't know if they invented it, but that is certainly where I first heard it.
They did not invent it, just like Underscore didn't invent exploding dinosaurs, yes.
Didn't I heard it first on Core Intuition, I thought.
I think it's probably from the invention of radio.
Yeah, I mean, well,
within podcasts.
Yeah, radio. Yeah, it's everyone does it a little bit differently, but the idea of just like kind of like a quick opening and closing sound effect. I first heard that on Hello Internet, so they get full credit because they are awesome and they are still my favorite podcast. I don't know. I'm just going to assume they stole something from us at some point and we'll call it even. And yeah, that's about it. We are also sponsored this week by FreshBooks. Go to freshbooks.com/ATP. FreshBooks has created cloud accounting software so ridiculously simple to use that over 5 million small business owners are officially feeling the FreshBooks effect. This means there's a lot more smiling and way less stressing when it comes to dealing with administration, paperwork, invoicing, and getting paid. Now, invoicing is what made them famous, and they are stellar at invoicing. You can use FreshBooks to create and send invoices in literally 30 seconds or less. There's no formulas, no formatting, no manual entry to make things, you know, error prone or anything. Just perfectly crafted invoices every time. Now, they also let you track your expenses. FreshBooks lets you forget about forgetting to track receipts and expense reports. You can use the FreshBooks app for mobile to take pictures of receipts on your phone and let FreshBooks pretty much handle the rest. And of course, you can manually enter expenses as well. And they even will integrate with your bank if you want them to automatically pull in expense transactions from your bank account. They also offer online payments, so when you create an invoice through FreshBooks for some service you provide, if somebody has to pay you for, you create an invoice, and the people you're invoicing can pay online. They support all sorts of payment gateways from their own to yours, and this means you get paid faster because it's easier for your clients to pay you. And if you do transactions in person, if you're some kind of in-person worker and you have to invoice people in person and get paid in person for what you just did, they have a mobile card reader that lets you accept credit cards right there. And so, again, helping you get paid faster. They also offer lots of little convenient features that way too many to cover in an ad read. One of the things they offer is overdue payment reminders. Now, every time I've ever sent an invoice, I've wished for this because invoices, you know, they get lost, they get delayed, they get put off. You always have people who are late to pay invoices. And it's great when FreshBooks can automatically, customizable by you on both the interval and the text, but can automatically send people late payment reminders. So they don't come from you. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to do it. It kind of helps avoid the uncomfortable conversation. This is only a tiny sliver of what FreshBooks can do for you. To feel the full force of the FreshBooks effect totally free for 30 days, go to freshbooks.com/ATP and enter Accidental Tech Podcast in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Once again, please enter ATP or Accidental Tech Podcast in the How Did You Hear About Us section when you go and sign up at freshbooks.com/ATP. Thanks to FreshBooks.
Unlike Smile, we need to wrap up addressing the various complaints of the bleeps and bloops. So collecting the bleeps and bloops complaints, one category of complaint is I don't like change. That's kind of like the meta category, which, you know, you can't dismiss out of hand because who wants their thing to, you know, you kind of get used to a certain structure. You don't like change, right?
But right, listen to episode one and tell me you don't like change.
Yeah. So we'll put that aside for now. but it is a thing people said. The other one, surprising number of people listen to the podcast. I don't know how we should take this, while drifting off to sleep or to help them, or this help them get to sleep. Like, I mean, great. If like, I'm happy to make a product that you enjoy for whatever purpose, you know, you want to use it for. If that's how you want to use it, that's fine. But apparently the bleeps and bloops are harshing their mellow and jangling them out of the slumber that they were drifting into. So perhaps toning down the volume or picking different sounds could help out there with those people. But again, a surprising number of people said that.
Yeah, that seems to be, I think that's the only complaint I would consider valid that we've received so far. And again, like you, I'm not sure how I feel about people complaining that they're having a hard time falling asleep through our podcast, but that is a semi-valid complaint.
If that's how they're using the podcast, then we're helping make their life better by helping them drift off to sleep. More power to them. So maybe the volume down.
Can you imagine people who hear us as the last thing they hear before they go to sleep? Like, what is that mentally healthy?
Like that's fine. We'll give them awesome dreams about USB hubs. USB hubs and new Mac Pros.
Oh, God. Those are nightmares, my friend, not dreams.
Yeah. My complaint is I don't like the sounds. Like, I know you went through all the list of sounds, but because you have no sort of background of what those sounds are, where they came from, it is weird to hear the sounds that you picked in there. So I feel like better sounds could be found. I like that they're Mac sounds, but I don't like that one of them is a crash sound. And of all the startup beeps you pick that one. Not my favorites. So I think there's an area where we could potentially improve to try to make, because I, you know, all the reasons that you cited for the sounds sound good to me. Like, I think they're all good, and we just need to tamp down the negatives, I feel like.
Sure. So, you know, if the issue is just like the volume of the sounds, I thought I had a good balance. I did reduce the volume on them from like their stock configuration, like from like the raw sound, just because it didn't match the levels really well otherwise. But if I have to reduce them further, that's fine. As for the choice of sounds, it's tricky when you're choosing sound effects for a podcast. I know this is really inside baseball. I'm sorry for everybody who doesn't care. You can just skip over this chapter. When you're choosing sound effects to go in a podcast, I learned this in the early days of Neutral, because I would use to delineate the ads in Neutral. I would use. Oh, wait a minute. That was before Hello Internet.
Say they stole everything from us.
All right. So we used the BMW chime from the E whatever series, whatever that
E90.
Whatever the pleasant little chime is when you like leave your door open or start the car or whatever. I recorded one of those from my 3 series, and we used that as our ad bumpers, and we got complaints from people. This is also why, like, when I bleep the sound effects, or when I bleep a swear word, I don't use the horn honking sound. There was a couple early episodes of Neutral where I would use all sorts of car sounds, and I've settled on just using a handbrake or a trunk slamming sound, because when you're in a car and you hear that sound effect, you don't, it kind of throws you off. You don't know whether, like, is that a real horn honking outside? Like, that's, it kind of scares you or jostles you out of what you're supposed to be paying attention to.
Is that the sound of my engine, or is that, no, it's an MP3, never mind.
Nice. Nicely done. So anyway.
We'll never get old. Did you know other car makers are doing that now, by the way? Not just BMW. I think I read, I forget what it was. Maybe it was Volkswagen or some other, but like just non-luxury, non-fancy brands are doing it. Anyway, it's terrible.
BMW leads the way in lots of things, good and bad. Anyway, so so I learned, like, you got to be careful not to use like current sounds. So when I chose these sounds, I chose them specifically so that they wouldn't sound like the more recent Mac sound effects. So, like, I didn't use the current Mac startup chime, which has actually been in use for quite some time. I didn't use that because it was, I didn't want people to think that, like, the computer behind them was rebooting, and they were like, oh, crap, did a kernel panic? Like, you know, I don't want to, like, freak people out. So I had to pick sounds that were not recent. And it would be funny to troll the Windows XP users with the USB sounds. And they are also quieter and simpler, and they wouldn't annoy you because they would match each other, John.
It's not the non-matching. It's just that I know those sounds from history and life. And they, you know, I think everything you said is a good idea, not to use modern sounds. Don't use sounds that could be confused with car sounds. Like, all good. But just these particular ones, they just don't work for me. Like, on Reconcilable Differences, Merlin has a little guitar jangle that he does at the beginning and end. And obviously, that's probably not appropriate for us, but on that show it works, especially because it fits in with the sort of intro theme thing. Anyway, I think we can do better here. Here's the other angle on this that no one brought up for the people who like don't like change and stuff. Having things like this, no matter what sounds we end up landing on and what volume they're at or whatever, having regular features of the show, like the song in the middle and the little ringy things and the car door opening and stuff like that, that stuff is incredibly addicting. Like like Pavlov with ringing the bell and making the dog salivate. Like, this is like a literal bell. Like, so for all the people who it's weird for you because we're changing it, totally understand that. But for the people who are just starting to listen to the show now, or for people a year from now, or after we've been doing this for a while, that will become such an integral part of the show that if we ever took it away, people would flip out because humans are just silly little monkeys. And, if, you know, so what I'm saying is hang in there. Eventually, you will come to love the bells. Maybe not these particular chimes. So we feel like we will get the kinks work out, and version 2 and 3 of these sounds or whatever, eventually you won't be able to live without them.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one of the reasons we have our theme song. So Jonathan Mann, the author of our theme song, we did the first few episodes without a theme song, or I forget how many we did beforehand, but it was a few. And like one time we complained that we didn't know how to end the show and everything. So he wrote this theme song. And at the same time, I had actually asked Merlin Mann like a week or so earlier if he could write us a theme song, because all those like musical things, like I think, I'm pretty sure that's just him playing guitar or playing on GarageBand or something. Like he is a musician.
Yep, that's him.
You know, Back to Work, that theme song was like his high school band or whatever.
High school band. I hope he's not listening.
Was it after high school? I don't know. Anyway.
They're a serious band, you know.
I bought their album. Anyway, it's Bacon Ray, right?
Yeah, I think that one is.
Yeah. So I actually asked Merlin, before Jonathan wrote what is now our theme song, I asked Merlin to write something for us. And then when Jonathan wrote his theme song, we were like, this is so good. Like, it was getting stuck in all of our heads all day. And we were like, I think we have to just use this. It's too good. We have to use this. It's so infectious. It gets in all of our heads so much. We don't have a choice. So I went to Merlin. I'm like, look, I'm sorry. Like, if you start anything, please stop. And fortunately, he hadn't gotten to it yet, so it wasn't like a huge deal. At least I don't think Merlin hates me forever for that, because that was like 3 years ago, and I think we're still friends. But yeah, like we knew, like when we heard the Jonathan Mann song, we knew we had to do it. By the way, quick plug for Jonathan Mann. He is launching a new podcast called Songonauts. On The Truth, one of the Radiotopia shows, you know, The Truth? It's a big podcast on Radiotopia. Anyway, so check out Songonauts by Jonathan Mann, which I think is launching shortly, or might have launched by the time we air this show. Anyway, quick plug for Jonathan, because we like him a lot, because he wrote our theme song. So anyway, that is why we do fun stuff like this, because it gets in our heads, and it becomes part of the personality of the show. And I like, John, your statement of basically like, oh, just stop your whining, you'll get used to it eventually.
It's not stop your whining, it's that you will not just get used to it. You will come to crave it. You will need it to be there. It will become a comforting regular, as any sort of routine, as any, you know, parent of a toddler knows. Regular, you know, having a routine. This is the time when we do this. It is comforting to have a routine, to know that no matter what crazy stuff goes on during the show, at a certain point, there's going to be these little jingles that demark the ads, and there's going to be a song, and maybe there's going to be a car sound. Like, those regular things, those routines, those traditions become comfort. You will come to love them. As long as we don't pick terrible sounds.
Or as long as we don't charge you $5 a month.
Yeah.
All right, so you want to talk about a topic, or do we just want to end here?
We have one more sponsor to do if you want.
I'm kidding. We talked last week. See, this is even a great topic. This is like halfway between follow-up and not. We talked last week about Apple's 40th birthday, and we went on a journey together through our finding the Mac and finding Apple. And we didn't talk much about the iMac, or at least not enough for John. So John, tell us about Apple turning 40 and the iMac.
Yeah, we were running over in our 40th thing, so I kind of cut that out of where I would have talked about my stuff. But I think it is an important part to acknowledge, and maybe you guys can relate to it, because maybe you have opinions on it or looking at it from afar. But so the iMac was 1998, and Steve Jobs had come back to Apple. And that, people don't remember, they usually think of the iPod as the important turnaround product, but the iMac was just as important, if not more important, for Apple as a company, not particularly for the industry, because in the end, they're like, oh, whatever, it was just a computer. People have made computers before. The important thing that the iMac did for Apple is, it seemed like, from the outside, that it gave the entire company, like, a little measure of pride back. Like, that it made them believe, oh, yeah, we can make cool things that people like that we're proud of. Because there was, you know, especially with Apple being near death in 1997 and going through different CEOs in the years before that and running out of money and having layoffs and having products that people weren't particularly happy with and not being able to field the next generation OS after repeated tries, and Windows 95 coming and just stomping all over their face and Marco feeling bad for people having Macs, it was getting harder and harder to be proud to be an employee of Apple. And so Steve Jobs and his typical, what would become his typical thing of having a secret group work on the secret project that no one knew about and having Johnny Ive make this amazing design for it that nobody saw, including the people who were working on it. The rumor mill, the Mac rumor mill, which was definitely still a thing back then, I remember them thinking it was a set-top box because I think the people working on the hardware, they didn't get to see what case it would go in. So to them, it just looked like a little flat box. And so the rumors that came out was like Apple's making a television set-top box, which, by the way, they did at one point and do now, but it's not much of a set-top. It's more of a set-top coaster. Anyway, the segregation of the teams working on this and the big dramatic reveal of we made a new computer. All right, so what, Apple? You made a new computer. You know, you made a new Mac. So what? There's a million Macs. And it is both minimizing and maximizing this to say that what was most important about it was the way the thing looked. It looked weird for a computer. It was teal. The color of blue was the name of a beach that I'm not going to pronounce after a long flame war on the Slack channel that I do not want to get involved in. But it was a particular kind of blue. And it was translucent, and it was cute, like the original Mac. And it was a super important product, both for Apple, because I feel like it made them proud of themselves again and set them on the road to greatness, and also for the entire industry, because with that product, the fact that there was such a reaction to it, when despite the fact that it was mostly just a run-of-the-mill Mac, and yeah, they ditched legacy ports and did other important things for Apple, like we're setting that aside for now, but it convinced the world, essentially, that the way computers look is a factor, which sounds so stupid. It's like saying, oh, this was the first car that convinced the world that cars should look good. Everyone accepts the cars have to look good. Everyone accepts there are ugly cars and pretty cars. And so many people factor in how a car looks in their car buying decisions. And cars cost thousands and thousands of dollars more than computers in most cases. And yet somehow we were always okay with cars having that for our lifetime, right? It took Apple to say, these computers, you should care how they look too, because who wants an ugly one? And for years, Apple had been making nice ones, but they were still somewhat constrained by the orthodoxy of the industry in terms of they were off-white or black or gray. Like, they weren't grape colored, right? You know, they were still within the limits of the computer as defined by Apple itself in the early days of, you know, the Apple II and everything, and all the other companies that made computers big and small. They sort of defined a boring aesthetic, and it took Apple to break out of that on the mass scale and say, we think this is cool, and you know what, I think customers will be tickled by the idea of a green computer, and we'll sell them to them, and they will buy a green computer, and they will love it because it's green. and it sounds like such a stupid thing in the age where we sell everything based on colors, and all, you know, our phones come in different colors and all sorts of, you know, in cases and everything like that. But back then, that was a very important revelation. So in the big timeline of Apple 40 years, you have to credit them along with bringing the GUI to the world, to the mass market. You have to also credit them. And again, it's not they weren't the first one, the only one to ever do this, but they essentially brought the idea to the mass market that it is important how computers look, and people will enjoy our products more if they like how they look. Which, again, sounds so stupid in retrospect, but was super important for the entire industry and led the way for everything that came after it. It's the reason you had translucent teal irons and can openers and stuff following the iMac, because people got the wrong idea of like, oh, we just need to make everything translucent and teal. It's like, you're taking the wrong... Nice. I like that you're enthusiastic. Good enthusiasm. You may be taking the wrong idea from things, or maybe you're just trying to cash in on the iMac trend. Either way, the whole industry of consumer electronics, I feel like, has circled out rippled out from that iMac, in that people are no longer afraid to do interesting things with their hardware, even if everything isn't as exuberant as lifesavers. Like, obviously they went to an extreme to make a point, you know, but today the variety of shapes and textures and yes, even colors of electronics is much greater, thanks in no small part to Apple.
Yeah, I remember, I mean, I was in college from 2000 to 2004. And, you know, it was a full-time college kind of thing. So we were in a dorm room, and everybody else in the dorm had appliances that they had purchased for their dorm room that were, you know, designed in 99, 2000, right after the iMac came out and made this big splash. And so they were all, as you mentioned, like the translucent plastic microwaves and phones and like old, you know, corded and wireless phones, not like cell phones, just any kind of appliance you could buy that was relatively inexpensive. Also, the other computers. I mean, the look of like Compaq towers at the time, and oh god, e-machines.
They would just snap. They would just snap on a faceplate. Like, yeah, they had the same beige box, but like, all right, mm-hmm, the one piece of this is plastic. Can we just mold that piece of plastic out of colored translucent plastic? Done. It's like, no, it's still a beige box with a thing stuck on the front.
Yeah, I mean, it was like the very first time, I think, in a while that the entire rest of the industry copied what Apple did at a remarkable pace and did so poorly. As you said, you know, totally missing the point of why this was good and what parts of it made it good. And yeah, everyone else just kind of copied like the high level design brief.
The surface details, which is not like, I mean, that's something, because it lets them not have to redesign everything. It lets them not have to have a design department like Apple does, right? And it lets them cash in slightly on people who have a vague notion that they saw a cool teal computer and they wander into Best Buy. But in the subsequent years, I think companies are way better now at copying not just Apple, but anyone. And that everybody, I'm continually impressed by these formerly very, you know, sort of boring and uninteresting and risk-averse PC makers, all of which are obviously hiring their own design departments to make interesting computer designs. I may not like them, but they are way more interesting than they used to be. Like, the Microsoft Surface is interesting with that weird hinge thing. That HP one that's super slim with the little shiny chrome hinges and everything. There's no way that the PC industry of the 90s, those companies, would even have a clue how to do that. So they're not just taking their existing computers and tacking a bunch of faceplates onto them. Even when they were copying Apple by saying, we're going to make silver aluminum laptops that look exactly like Apple's ones, they still did a better job of that than they did of copying the iMac. At the times of the iMac, they didn't know their butt from their elbow. They had no idea what they were doing. They were just like, put something teal on it. Are we done now? I think so. Good. Ship it.
It was literally just bolted on. Like they already had the regular mid tower that they were shipping, and they just shoved this giant bulbous faceplate on it that had this little translucent section you could pop out and replace the color if you really wanted to. Like, wow. It was a really dark time for PCs.
Yeah, but at least they got the message. The message was, and it's not like it's not like the iMac was selling millions and millions and millions more than they were selling. They were still selling more than Apple, especially in those days. It's just that they saw the splash it made. It's like, why don't people care about our computer like they care about that? Are our computers boring? Do people want their computers to look nice? Like, it was this strange awakening of, again, things that sound so stupid and obvious to us now. But back then, if you didn't live through it, it may seem crazy to think that so many of the most dominant computer makers in the world, this kind of design was not even on their radar. And as far as they were concerned, a Mac 2Ci was exactly the same as a PC XT case, which just was not the case, and Mac users could see it, but nobody else could until Apple made something teal and translucent.
This is tangentially related, but Marco talking about college and people with iMacs and not having iMacs and whatnot made me remember that Marco and I are the same age, so we went to school at the same time. And when I was at Virginia Tech, they had, and I believe still do, a very, very large off-campus computer lab called the Math Emporium, and it was specifically suited for math related work, but it had at the time a gazillion Macs in it. And I remember two things vividly about the Mac Emporium in terms of the hardware there. Number one, the hockey puck mouse is the worst mouse that's ever been created in the history of man. Number two, I vividly remember there being G4 cubes all over it when I was there. There were like hundreds of them. And I remember going to this place and thinking, wow, that is a very peculiar design for a computer, but man, that's kind of cool. And I remember also VNCing into my full tower desktop that I had in my dorm room, and I thought I was the coolest kid in the world because a guy down the hall had shown me what VNC was. And the fact that I could log into my computer from somewhere else, it was mind-blowing.
Oh, that was amazing back then.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't have the X window system on your college campus?
No.
You could run programs on a different computer and have the result displayed on your computer. Like it was a terminal for the X window system. We call it an X term.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. And actually, I think that the Math Emporium was largely running on some sort of Citrix setup, which is a similar idea. But yeah, I just remember just a sea of G4 cubes.
I wonder where I'd never seen a like I'd seen people who had been suckered into buying a lot of various kinds of computers, not suckered, but, you know, like a computer that later turned out to not be a particular popular model, sort of faded away. Like the one I remember is that Rose Hulman, which is a small college somewhere that a friend of mine went to. The Next salesman visited Rose Hulman and convinced them that Next computers were the best thing since sliced bread. And honestly, they were the best thing since sliced bread. So they sold Next computers to Rose Hulman. They were everywhere. And then Next was not so much into selling hardware pretty shortly after that, which must have felt bad if you were the one in charge of buying hardware for Rose Hulman. But on the other hand, if you went to Rose Hulman during that time, everybody got to use like Next Cubes and Next Labs, which was like living in the future, really, because even though it was kind of boring and gray and a lot of the displays were grayscale instead of full color, Next Step was still pretty amazing. That hardware looked awesome. I got a bunch of it in my attic.
Our final sponsor tonight is Betterment. Go to betterment.com/ATP. Betterment is investing made better. Now, it's never too late to start saving for retirement or your other financial goals. The financial services industry has embraced technology with the entry of automated investing and robot advisors. Now, Betterment is the largest automated investing service out there. You've probably been hearing a lot about them in TechCrunch, The Wall Street Journal, and other major news outlets. Betterment makes it easier, more straightforward, and less expensive to invest, with way lower fees than what you usually see from financial services. They've built on smarter, cutting-edge technology to bring you sophisticated investing and financial advice, all at a much lower cost than most traditional financial services. More than 150,000 customers choose Betterment's advanced advice algorithms and beautiful user interface to manage over $4 billion of their customer dollars. This is the perfect time to get started with Betterment and to start saving for your retirement or your other financial goals. Now, ATP listeners can get up to 6 months of no fees. Learn how at betterment.com/ATP. Once again, up to 6 months of no fees if you go to betterment.com/ATP. Betterment, investing made better.
I think we found bumper sounds. Why don't we just have all of us make sounds with our mouth and then Parker will just put them in? It will solve the problem of like, this is too jarring because I just want to hear your voices. This will be our voices. It won't be a familiar sound in a car or of a modern computer. And it's royalty free, right?
I don't know. I might run a royalty on mine.
Yeah, seriously. One of us might change our minds.
Now that you're a recording artist. The vocal stylings of Marco Arment.
Yeah, does that change the licensing of like how, you know, how we can use clips? Do I have to go through ASCAP or whatever?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So a few days ago, as we record, actually just a couple days ago, I wrote a post coming to the defense of the Apple Watch. The post was entitled "Poor Apple Watch," and I just feel like lately it's been very trendy to poop all over the Apple Watch. Oh, it's a piece of crap. It's so slow. It's too fat. The software doesn't do anything useful. It's not cool. Look at me. I'm going to get either a mechanical watch or not use a watch at all. And that's fine. You know, if that's fine for you or for Merlin or for Marco, that's fine. Do what you got to do. But I feel like nobody was coming to the defense of the Apple Watch. And so I thought, you know what? I will come to the defense of the Apple Watch. And I just wrote a post saying that, you know what? I like my watch and it is fat and it is slow and the apps are pretty much entirely useless. But for me, that's okay. I still like having the smart features of my smartwatch on my wrist. I think a lot of this may come from the fact that I leave the house to go to work. And I'm not saying that to be snarky or smug. I'm saying that genuinely, that I have appointments and meetings and things that happen throughout my day, obligations throughout my day that have to happen at certain times. And so having my next calendar appointment on my watch face is very convenient. Additionally, I don't get to leave the building at work and occasionally the house if Declan's awake. I don't get to leave where I am whenever I want, just on a lark. And so having the temperature on my watch face is really nice. And on top of that, I like having the activity rings, particularly the stand ring, because as we all know, I happen to be a blue ring stud. So yes, there's a lot to dislike about the Apple Watch, full stop. I completely agree. The apps are useless. I never use them. I really never use glances for the most part. I wish we had custom watch faces. I would love to be able to do more with complications, either have more of them on the screen or maybe have them be more intelligent somehow. I'm not even sure how. But all in all, I still really like my Apple Watch. And I'm looking around and I'm starting to feel like I'm the only one. John, are you wearing yours?
No, we talked about this a while ago, but yeah, I bailed on using it mostly because I found myself going through entire days without having any meaningful interaction with it, including checking it for the time, which is not a habit I had. And I'm not a watch wearer, and it annoys me to have a thing on my wrist. So I have built-in negatives in that anything mm-hmm. you put on my wrist has to overcome my aversion to ever having anything on my wrist ever. And I don't have any habits built in for watches, so I needed a positive to offset that. And when the positives evaporated, I stopped wearing it. And the positives were like, I like the notifications, I like the texts, and I like the activity tracking, but that wasn't enough to overcome my desire to not have something on my wrist. Although now that I'm about to, travel, I'm going to bring my watch with me and probably wear it when I'm on vacation, because if I'm walking around a different city, it is convenient to be able to, for example, set a destination on your phone and then put your phone in your pocket and not have to take it out again and just walk there and have your wrist tell you which way to go. Same thing for driving. I kind of like that. I don't need it when I'm going to and from work every day. There's no directions I need to have. But if you're in an unfamiliar place driving around, it's nice to have that. So I still think it has value. I still like it. I still like how it looks. I still don't like wearing a watch. That's pretty much where it is. It spends most of its time on my dresser.
Do you hate having something on your wrist because of your shag carpet arm hair, or just because you hate having something on your wrist?
I think it's mostly because of RSI, actually. Like, it's the same reason I stopped wearing my wedding ring, is that I'm just very sensitive to have anything in that area as I'm sitting there and typing all day. Just everything about it is sensitive. I don't want any pressure on it. I don't want anything grabbing it. I don't want anything rubbing against it. Even, like, the wrong kind of, like, sleeve cuffs when I wear long sleeves can bother me. So, and that I don't have any ingrained habits of, like, I'm always looking at my wrists. I just, again, I think we discussed this before. Last time I wore a watch was, like, middle school when I just became old enough to have a watch and wanted to try it out, and I wore it for a little while, like some plastic little digital watch, and decided it wasn't for me. So I'm just not a watch person.
Fair enough. All right. So I wanted to save you for last, Marco. Do your worst.
Well, I mean, first of all, I think it's not a very good argument to say, like, well, it seems trendy to hate this thing right now. That's just whoever you're reading, which includes people like me who aren't who are cooling or have cooled on the Apple Watch. Mm-hmm. I think what we're seeing here, I mean, there's a number of factors here. I don't question the Apple Watch's utility for a lot of people. But and in fact, I found a lot of utility when I wore it as well. It just, the downsides of it just bothered me too much, and I found that I preferred regular watches rather than, I went from no watch to an Apple Watch to, oh, I like watches, turns out, but most of what I do is tell the time, and regular watches just do a way better job of that for my purposes, because they're always on and you don't have to charge them, etc. What I found that, I think if you look kind of like globally, if you step back from, what any individual's personal needs are and personal opinions about the Apple Watch are, I think you can step back and you can see this product as really a really mixed bag as a 1.0 product. And there's a few things that exacerbate this, one of which is that it's going more than a year as a 1.0. And we talked about this before, so I don't want to go too far into it, but like, it's looking like we're not going to get a good successor to it for, at least now, which is now is like a year after it came out. We're at least not getting it now. We might not even get it until the summer or the fall or even next spring. We don't actually know when there's going to be, second generation, and where the second generation will be very good or, very much of an improvement in the areas that any person thinks that it needs it. So we are still judging this thing on generation one, but generation one is not only longer than these things usually are. Usually they're a year or less. So it's not only being a long generation one, but also I feel like the generation one hardware and software were both pretty mediocre on the scale of like various Apple first gen products. Certainly not every Apple first gen product is a great product or is a huge hit, but I think as they go, especially in recent years, as they go, I think the watch has been a pretty mediocre one, in terms of like bugs, performance, limitations, things like that. What we're finding with Apple, I've talked before about this issue with like the low hanging fruit has all been picked everywhere. And so what we have now is like the kind of baseline products, the Macs, the iPhones, to most of a degree, the iPads. These things are mature. The innovation on them has slowed, but they're pretty awesome. They have, you know, they have great performance. They have great physical characteristics, a great balance between like size and weight and battery life for the most part, you know, very few exceptions. These are all very mature products. But Apple is a company that depends on trying to sell its customers more devices and trying to sell devices to more customers. So it is Apple's job as a hardware maker to just try stuff in the market to say, you know, hey, everybody has a phone. A lot of people have computers. Most people have computers. Does everybody also need a tablet? Let's try. Does everybody also need a watch? Let's try. Does everybody also need a TV box? Let's try. You know, that is their job. But all these mature things that are like the core of things, you know, basically the computers and the phones and maybe the tablets, that covers most people's needs. So we are accustomed to judging Apple and their products based on those products, those core products, mostly the computer and the phone, which is like, yeah, sure, almost everyone could use those. And so it's easy to look at that and say, well, if Apple makes a computer or a phone that sucks for me, then that kind of sucks for everybody. And why do they do it? You know, and whether that's true or not, it's easy for people to look at it that way. With the watch, I feel like we went into it with that kind of expectation. And a lot of people bought it based on the expectation of like, it's a new high profile Apple product line. Of course it's going to be for me. Of course it's going to be for everybody. And of course it's going to be good. And I think what we're seeing is it's hard to find new things that are for everybody in technology, new things that are going to be potentially as big as phones or computers or tablets or anything else. These are hard problems. And the watch, you know, because of the incredibly strong demands, that the conflicting demands of that kind of product, you have severe size constraints, severe power constraints, it's really severe cost constraints. It's just very hard to get a good smartwatch product on the market. It's just really hard to do. And I think what we're seeing is this is an Apple product that we thought was going to be for everybody, but just isn't. It's just not, it's just like you can look at any kind of watch and you can, you know, no kind of watch is for everybody, not even Rolex or Omega people, sorry. not every watch is for everybody. And the Apple Watch has not replaced all watches and has not replaced everybody's phones or anything like that and never will. It is a product that is going to work for some people, but it's not a home run for everybody. Or even the people who it works for. It's not even a home run necessarily for them. It's just decent, maybe, you know. But it's hard to make new stuff that is going to be really great anymore because so much of it's already been made and has already matured in these areas and the areas of technology and, you know, things like this that people are you know, working on in this industry. So I don't think it's bad to say the Apple Watch isn't for me, and I don't think it's a sign that the watch has failed. If a lot of people think it's not for them, but I also think that the watch as a 1.0 product was really done with a lot of mediocrity, and it is not unfair to criticize that. These are real shortcomings it has. It has real problems, real shortcomings, really, you know, real design question marks and missed opportunities and weird choices that they made, and all of this will probably be fixed over time. I hope it is. And maybe someday I'll go back to it as a product that I use on a regular basis, because there are things about it that I do miss. You know, like I think I mostly miss it while driving. That's like, you know, to have like the quick glance of like, why did my phone just vibrate in my pocket while I'm driving? Which is probably unsafe, and I probably shouldn't even look at the watch, but that is when I miss it. And so overall, though, I think, again, these are hard problems, and we are in an era now where the new things that Apple makes are not going to be guaranteed to be mass market. And that's probably okay.
I think the watch was a good bet for mass market, though, because wearables have a much broader appeal than computing devices, because many more people spend more time wearing things during the day than they spend using computers. I'm not saying everybody is a watch wearer, but just wearables as a category. Like, if you had to pick a category of areas that Apple should get into, they're kind of on the cusp of like, well, we mostly do computery things, and we're getting to the point where you can have a computery thing that's part of clothing or jewelry in some way. Does that mean glasses like Google was doing? Does it mean watches? Does it mean like a little fitness turd like Fitbit is doing or something else? As a category, I think this was a very smart bet for Apple to get into. Their first entry in the category, you know, they'll learn, they'll move on. I hope they don't abandon it, because if you're looking for another mass market thing, the categories they're looking at are all potential winners. Lots of people watch television or watch video, so something having to do with TV is a good idea. Lots of people have cell phones. That was a good market for them. Lots of people wear things, also a good market. And as computers get smaller and lighter weight and the power requirements go down and so on and so forth, that entire category will only become more viable. So if I had to look like broad strokes, long-term product strategy, I think it was really smart for Apple to get into wearables, and I really hope they do stick it out, learn their lessons, make better products, keep iterating and innovating, because these type of products play to all of their strengths: miniaturization, mass manufacturing of beautiful objects, especially the ability to make things that are appealing to people visually that we just talked about with the iMac. That's important when you're wearing it. And Apple has shown with their watch bands and their watch designs, within the constraints of the tech available, they're actually pretty good at that part of it too.
Yeah.
They just have to figure out how to make the product part of it. And if I think about the first iPod, it was pretty crappy too. It's just that the first iPod had such a huge positive to outweigh its negatives. And the watch is like, it has some positives to outweigh some of its negatives, but net, it is not as compelling a product.
Yeah. And ultimately, I think what gives me concern about the watch is the apparent slow pace of progress. And, you know, we will see what happens the next time there is a substantial update to either the hardware or the software. We'll see, you know, I this could totally change my tone about it, but right now it appears to be moving pretty slowly.
I don't know. I don't outright disagree with anything you just said, but if we really step back and think about it, first of all, as someone who works in an office building like John does, I see so many Fitbit, bracelety, watchy things, I can't even count them. And I concur with what John said, that wearables are a market that I think it's going to be getting a bit, going to be a bigger and bigger market with time. And I think that Apple playing in this market is a wise choice. Recently, it was a day or two ago, I watched that classic Louis C.K. Video when he was on Conan about people getting pissed off about not having Wi-Fi in their flying tube. You know, people getting all upset about the fact that they're in an airplane and don't have Wi-Fi. And this is not the same as people getting upset about their watch. But at the same time, I have a mini computer on my friggin' wrist that can, with limitations, connect to almost all the known information on the planet on the internet. That's pretty freaking amazing. And I agree that there's a lot that's frustrating about my watch. I never use apps for several different reasons, number one of which, it's so slow to do anything, and it's infuriating. Nevertheless, I have this device that tracks my heartbeat. It tracks how much I'm standing, how much I'm moving. It tracks when my next appointment is. Like John was saying, if I'm in a city that I'm not familiar with and I'm walking around, I can do so without having my phone out screaming, "I'm a tourist, please rob me." There's so many things for me that I really like about this, and that impressed me so deeply about it, especially given the unbelievable engineering constraints that this product was made under. It's to me, it's such an impressive product, and there is so much that could be done to make it better, Marco. You're absolutely right about that. I mean, I can't argue with that at all. But for me, it's still something that adds value to my life, and I still like it. And I just feel like, I think the thing of it is that it was like a switch flipped, and suddenly everyone was talking about how much they don't want to wear an Apple Watch anymore. And that in and of itself, that's fine, but it just seemed weird to me. And I felt bad for the poor little Apple Watch, and I still feel bad for the poor little Apple Watch. It's a cute little feller. And I feel like somebody needed to build it up a little bit.
I don't know enough people who are not tech nerds who have an Apple Watch to know how it's playing in the non-tech nerd crowd, because obviously we're all talking to other tech nerds and they're the ones writing things about how they're not using their watch and whatever. And yeah, it did kind of all come together because I think people slowly stopped wearing them And then the people who needed to tell the world that they slowly stopped wearing them had to write stories about it. And then other people saw the stories and they felt safe that they could now admit that they'd slowly stopped wearing them, which is fine. Like, yep. That's how the press cycle goes. But it's still all within just the sort of tech nerd circles. And I'm sure the watch is selling outside tech nerd circles. You can tell by the huge spike in sales that they seem to have from everything we're able to understand from Apple's closely guarded secrets about how many watches they're selling exactly during the holidays. Because tech nerds don't save their spending for the holidays. They buy it as soon as it's released.
No, I've actually, you know, anecdotally, I've seen, since the holidays, I've seen a lot more Apple Watches in the real world, oftentimes on you know, non-geeks or at least people whose geek status is unknown to me.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. They must be selling them. It's just I don't know those people. So I can't sort of get a read on, like, none of my family or friends who are not tech nerds have an Apple Watch. So I would love to know what regular people think of the Apple Watch. It's just still kind of unknown to us. Surely Apple knows because it's their job to know. I can imagine regular people not being as picky about it, but also not becoming eternally addicted to it like they were once you started selling iPods to regular people. Once it wasn't a $400 accessory that only worked with Macs, like once, you know, you had the Mini and stuff, people love their iPods, man. They love them. Like, do people love their Apple Watch or do they say, it's pretty cool and it was a good Christmas present that I got? But I don't know if they are so incredibly in love with it as they were with their smartphones or their iPods or whatever. So we'll see next Christmas and how they iterate on this. I'm entirely open to the idea that Apple can try other kinds of wearables, whether it's a fitness turd or, you know, an earring or a ring or something involving glasses. And there was discussion on Twitter today about Apple, Cable Sasser of Panic was disappointed that Apple wasn't anywhere on the radar when it came to VR. And if you wanted to do VR, you had to basically build a PC because no Mac, we already discussed this, no Mac you can buy is viable for it, which isn't entirely true because the Mac is technically capable of doing a VR experience, but the current VR products, the pioneers of the VR industry are either, you know, you need a game console or you need a PC, and no matter what Mac you have, forget it. And so he was, Cable was concerned that Apple was missing out on this, that they are watching this one go by. And again, we've talked many times about the supposed rumored VR things that Apple is surely toying with internally, but as far as I'm aware, there's no credible rumors about Apple fielding any products in that area. I think they should be experimenting with it, and same thing with wearables. I think they should be experimenting with everything having to do with wearables, not just watches. And some feedback we got recently was like, you guys say that Apple is spread too thin, but on the other hand, you're always saying Apple has to be checking out everything. There's a difference between fielding a product or a platform or investigating it. Like, Apple's job is to try everything, to see, you know, not in the market, but like try it out internally. Make sure someone is working on VR. Make sure someone's working on this, that. Maybe not cars, right? But everything that's close to their industry. Don't let it catch you by surprise. And then figure out of all those things, is this some place where we can sell a good product? You know, can we make a significant contribution to this market? How big is the potential market? Like, that's what they should be doing internally. What you can't do is actually say, we need to be in every single market, like Microsoft in the 90s. We need to make, if there's a technological thing that can run software, we need to make one of them, and we need to sell it as a product, and we need to support it forever, because then you just end up with too much crap. So it's being spread too thin is when you do more than you can do externally, and then doing due diligence internally is saying, we need to be looking at everything. We need to not be caught by surprise. We need to, at the very least, be making an internal determination of, it's not time for us to enter that market, but we'll continue to look at it. Because it's so much cheaper to just continue to investigate internally. It gets really expensive once you say, and you know what, we're going to make a product. That's one of the rumors about the car, by the way, is someone inside decided we can innovate in the car space, whether it's with electric cars or self-driving cars or whatever they're going to do, right? And the rumor I heard was that Apple had essentially said they're willing to spend $1 billion on development of a car and then walk away from the entire project if it doesn't look like it's working out. So that's like, again, it's just a rumor, who knows, but that's the mindset you have to go in with, because how do you know whether you can do something good in the car space? You can think about it all you want, but at a certain point, someone has to say, all right, I think we can do something here. Let's give it a try. And if you have budgets the size of Apple, you can say, all right, we'll put $1 billion into this, and then we'll revisit. And we'll say, once we spend $1 billion, what do we think, guys? Is this ready? And gals, this is a lifetime of sexist language cemented in my freaking brain. Anyway, What do we think of this? Is this going to be a product worthy of Apple? Should we release it? And that's where Marco comes and yells at you and says, you know what? Maybe the watch wasn't a product worthy of Apple quite yet. We think wearables are great, but when it's time to give the go, no go, maybe let it bake a little bit longer. Anyway.
Or maybe it was the wrong approach.
Yeah. The rumored attitude with the car, I think, is the right attitude, is get while the getting is good. You've got a lot of money. You can invest a lot. Just because you put $1 billion into it doesn't mean you actually have to ship a car. You could put $1 billion in and say, we thought we could do something really interesting here, and it turns out we can't. Lesson learned, move on. That's doing your due diligence. If they're doing that in VR, we've been looking at VR for 2 decades. We've had people doing AR and VR internally. We've been investigating it for as long as we've been investigating anything, any of the other technologies that we actually released, like touchscreens and voice recognition and all these things that we've been doing in labs forever and ever in Apple. And it's time to come out with a product. When we feel like we can make a contribution, we will, and until then, we won't. So that's why we always just assume here on the outside. Well, of course, Apple's looking into VR. And then sometimes in our darker moments, you think, right? Right, Apple? You're at least experimenting with it internally. It doesn't mean you need to feel the product today. It doesn't mean you must compete with the Oculus Rift today. Like, there's so many questions about VR. It's still, you know, we still don't know what's going to happen there. But we just hope that Apple, as the richest technology company in the world, at the very least, is investigating all these avenues. And for wearables, same thing. You can wear a lot of technology things on your body, and a lot of people wear things on their body every day, and if Apple could sell them something that makes their lives better, that would be perfect.
Thanks a lot to our three sponsors this week, Meh.com, FreshBooks, and Betterment, and we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin. Cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him. Cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYL. ISS, so that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse, it's accidental.
We can talk about that Mac OS thing, or...
Oh, yeah, I didn't get a chance to read
what
that.
What are all these... So what's John's Mongoose Californian? What the hell is that? It's been on our show notes for, like, 3 years.
It's a bike.
Yep, it should stay there, because I can talk about it sometime, but not today.
Why not today?
Because I'm not prepared for it. Not ready.
The whole... You know what the whole purpose of this show is.
You know what,
right?
I mean? It's not like I need to, I just need to know that it's a thing we're going to talk about tonight. No, the Mac OS thing is a good idea because I forgot that was there and I did look at that page.
Yeah, so I didn't get a good look at it. I looked at the pictures though and I really liked them.
that's a lot of it. So, yeah, so there's this blog post by Andrew Ambrosino on Medium called Mac OS, MACOS, the lowercase Mac way that we think they're going to rename it, : it's time to take the next step. And he basically outlines a number of like substantial changes that that he thinks should be done or he proposes might be good to Mac OS in things like design and interface changes and really kind of making it. He was originally responding a little bit to Steve Troughton Smith's claim back in his WWDC wish list post a couple weeks back that he was saying Steve Troughton Smith said that he really believes that OS X is a dead platform and kind of elaborated on that. So Andrew here basically kind of took that further and was like, well, you know, what does OS X need to kind of take the next level to remain relevant to go the next step? And there's a number. If I could summarize it, he basically makes the interface look a lot more like iOS apps that are kind of being windowed in a regular OS X environment. So it's a significant design refresh around a more iOS-y style for lots of apps in the system, rather than what we have now, which is kind of like mostly AppKit styles, and then some apps like Photos are more iOS-y. And then he proposes a few other things, like a new file system, ding, and a few other things. So I don't know. What do you guys think of this? I think it's really interesting.
I think it does not look as much like iOS as you think it does. And I also think it doesn't take much to get a designer's juices flowing. I think all you need to throw them is the, again, mostly agreed upon by the people out in the outside world, renaming of the operating system to match iOS and tvOS and watchOS to have a lowercase m on macOS that we've been talking about for months and months. I think that's basically all you need. You could just put that little grain of sand in the mind of a designer, and they immediately want to design screenshots of what this OS will look like, starting like as this one does with the about screen. Because if you don't think that changing the capitalization and naming of an operating system can lead to a visual design, you don't have much of a designer in you, because it doesn't take much to get that ball rolling. And I like these screenshots, but they remind me a lot of what I see whenever there is a new Mac operating system coming. Designers want to say, this is how I would make it look. And I have to say that most of them, I feel like, are doing a surface treatment. They are reskinning without rethinking any of the paradigms, because they have a dock on the bottom, a menu bar on the top, they have windows with Windows widgets and toolbars and search fields and sidebars and master detail views and table views and scrolling lists of thumbnails. And it's like, that's not rethinking anything. That's exactly what the Mac operating system is now and what it has been for years and years. And just because on your video player you put a big circle, kind of like there is on the iPhone camera, does not to change the interface of dealing with video on the Mac at all. Like, a real paradigm shift would be away from some aspect that has defined the Mac and the basic desktop GUI operating system, whether that's, you know, in the modern era, the dock, but really just movable, resizable windows with widgets and toolbars and a menu bar on the top of the screen, like when you come down to it. And I'm not saying that needs to change, but anybody who's like, this needs to be, we need to have a rethink of the Mac because it is stagnating, and then they show a reskin type of thing, that's, there seems to be a disagreement between the spirit of the text and the actuality of the images. Even though I'm sure these images are exciting to the person who drew them, and they do look kind of cool, even if they do look a little bit like the current look and feel of the system, maybe just dressed up a little bit. If your pitch is in the text that needs a radical rethink, then the screenshot should be a radical rethink, and I don't think these are. On the other hand, if your pitch is, as we talked about in the past shows, that the Mac should be take advantage of its maturity and just decrease the number of bugs and increase performance and stability over and over again until it is just like rock solid, super responsive, like a game console in the olden days when there was no such thing as frame rate drops and just everything happens because the screen can handle 8 sprites on the screen at the time and they're always perfect and there's never any drop in frame rate and everything is perfectly responsive and stable and the thing never crashes because you can't do a software update because it's on a cartridge and nothing's ever going to change. Anyway, not that it has to be a nostalgic type of thing, but like that is another route you can go with the Mac. Not going to radically rethink it, make it the best version of the current Mac operating system that it could possibly be, as in the same paradigm, resizable windows, scroll bars, window widgets, menu bars. That is a powerful paradigm that has lasted us a long time, and you can do amazing things with it, and there's nothing really particularly broken about it for the current customers of the Mac. Plenty of things broken out for the mass market who would much rather use their smartphones. You know, but again, setting that aside for now, if you're going to take the Mac on face value for what it is, who wouldn't love a Mac that reacted to your input faster, that did everything faster, that never crashed, that never stalled, that never did anything weird? Can you do that? It's easier to do that if you say that's all we're going to do with this thing. We're not going to try to come up with big important features every single time. We're going to say if there's a big important feature crying out to be implemented, by all means we'll implement it, but if there's not, we will not feel ashamed to spend an entire year just polishing the hell out of the Mac operating system. I know I would love that, and I know a lot of their existing customers would love that, and maybe you could say that defines a dead platform because stability equals death, but that is one possible route to go to make the people who use the Mac now love it even more, and I think to extend its life, because in order for the Mac to continue to be viable, it has to continue to offer things better than iOS, and iOS is getting better all the time. And if the Mac operating system is not also getting better, eventually those lines in the graph will cross and there's no more point for having the Mac.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really comes down to, like, you know, is the Mac being treated, you know, platform-wise, software-wise, is it being treated like the MacBook Air, which is kind of like, you know, just we're going to keep selling it for a while until it becomes irrelevant or dies, and then we're just going to kind of stop? Or is it an active platform that Apple wants to keep going indefinitely. And I think it's the latter. I think we've, you know, we've heard comments to that effect from Craig Federighi, and I think maybe even from Phil Schiller. And so, you know, it does seem like that is the idea, that the Mac is not dead. It's not just in maintenance mode until it gets subsumed by iOS. It does seem like they want to keep moving it forward. It really just needs, you know, maybe the resources to do that, and maybe they're doing that already. I don't know, but if they're going to keep it going as a platform, I think I'm about to make a John argument here, but like they have to eventually make like massive jumps in certain areas. Like eventually, like whatever we know as OS X, there's going to be like, you know, Mac OS 11 or whatever. Whatever it's going to be called, like eventually there's going to be like the next big jump forward on this platform, or at least there needs to be if it's going to remain relevant. It's hard to tell whether it's getting the resources and the attention it needs internally to be on track for that, or whether they're mostly focused on iOS right now. But I don't know.
Yeah, maybe the naming like is their way of doing this. I always wonder if they're going to reset the version numbers. They start from 1.0. This is Mac OS 1.0. And under the covers, of course, they would still be like, you know, 10, 12, whatever, just for software backward compatibility. Kind of like how Windows has the crazy versioning number that got skewed off because they continued the NT versioning numbers, I think, after 2000. Yeah. Anyway, I can imagine that them doing something like that. That's not the big reset that we're talking about. This was the other direction. It's like, all right, then radically rethink it. Radically rethink the Mac operating system. Do another Mac OS X style transition. That can be dangerous too, because you could just be annoying the remaining customers you have, and they say, forget this. If I'm going to go through this big change, I'm just going to learn how to use an iPad Pro. I don't know, but at the very least, renaming and reskinning can actually go a long way towards getting people excited about a platform again, even if it's all service details. If you also do some other things right, that's another free gimme. Like, do you want to do a make things faster and fix bugs release, but make people think it's a feature release, just change how everything looks. And they'll be like, whoa, this new Mac operating system, it's crazy, when all they did was change graphics, and then they spent the whole rest of the time fixing bugs and increasing performance. And as someone who writes software and someone who likes software updates, I'm obviously more excited than normal people are about this. I love when a new version of a software product that I use comes out, that they tell me something in it is faster. I love that. Because, you know, as a programmer, I love doing that. I love, you know, deleting code that no longer has execute on every, you know, frame of animation or on every time this thing happens. Like, I love better algorithms that scale better with large amounts of content, handles huge numbers of photos better. Like, you know, even just something as simple as better responsiveness during scrolling, or like, you know, loading things or whatever. Like, performance, I love things when they get better like that. And regular people don't really care about that, but they feel it. They, you know, if you do that consistently, people have sort of this intangible feeling that your product is better than others in ways they can't explain, simply because it reacts. In the same way that if you give someone the original iPhone and then gave them another touchscreen phone, another contemporary touchscreen phone, everyone could tell you that the iPhone was way better, even if they don't know, like, oh, I recognize this is a superior product because the hardware is nicer, or the stupid thing actually reacts to my finger. Like, they don't have to understand the nuances of finger reaction, but the general public immediately saw that, oh, this is different than the touchscreen that I hate on my ATM. This touchscreen is awesome. The ATM's touchscreen is terrible. And I don't need to tell you the technical reasons why. I just recognize it. So if you make a product that is more stable, more reliable, and faster and more responsive, and you keep doing that on a regular basis, customers will react. They will love your product more. And those of us in the know will also react. And not that you don't need to win us over. The real win is everyone else who will feel that. But boy, I love products. I just, you know, that's any product that has in their release notes, bug fixes are good, performance improvements. And I get the feeling, speaking of like dead platforms and everything, that people seem to think that there's nothing in the Mac applications they use from day to day, or the operating system itself, that can get faster. Like, well, this is just how computers are. And I just reject that notion entirely. Like, everything on my computer can and should be faster, even just on the software side. Like, ignoring that, yes, I think they should be faster CPUs, faster storage, faster graphics card. Yes, that should all continue to happen.
Which you wouldn't buy.
As Apple can. Right, yeah. But just even within the same hardware, there are things you can do to make the software faster. So many things can be done. Like that poor guy I see on Twitter who just spends all day trying to make NS User defaults faster. I love that guy. Just, yes, please do spend an entire year making NSUSE defaults faster. Please, you should, because you know what? That's used by tons of applications. If you make it just a little bit faster, you'll save us all a lot of time. My computer will be better. So keep making things faster.